Disc 2.
I'm trying to give your heart a break, I told him, and the others guffawed loudly. We all pick on Jerome. The five of us have been getting together informally for a couple of weeks. We were beginning to work on the Jane Does, as we called them. Homicide had no official investigation going on. It wasn't trying to link the murders to a serial killer. I'd tried to start one and been turned down by Chief Pittman. He claimed that I hadn't discovered a pattern linking any of the murders, and besides that, he didn't have any extra detectives for duty in Southeast. I suppose you've all heard about Nina Childs by now, Sampson asked the other detectives. All of them had known Nina, and of course Jerome had been at the murder scene with us. The good die young. Rakeem Powell frowned severely and shook his head. Rakeem is smart and tough and could go all the way in the department. Least they'd do in Southeast. His eyes went cold and hard. I told them what I knew, especially that Nina had been found with no ID. I mentioned everything else I had noticed at the tenement crime scene. I also took the occasion to talk some more about the rash of unsolved murders in Southeast. I went over the devastating stats I had compiled, mostly in my free time.
Statistic like that in Georgetown or the Capital District? People in this city be enraged, going ballistic. Be Washington Post headlines every day. The president himself be involved. Money no object, national tragedy.
Jerome Thurman railed on and waved his arms around like signal flags. Well, we are here to do something about it, I said in a calmer voice. Money is no object with us. Neither is time. Let me tell you what I feel about this killer, I continued. I think I know a few things about him.
How'd you come up with the profile? Sean Moore asked. How can you stand thinking about these kinky bastards as much as you do?
I shrugged. It's what I do best. I've analyzed all the Jane Does, I said. It took me weeks working on my own. Just me and the kinky bastard.
Plus, he studies rodent droppings, said Sampson.
I saw him bagging a little turds.
That's his real secret.
I grinned and told them what I had so far. I think one male is responsible for at least some of the killings. Maybe as many as a dozen murders. I don't think he's a brilliant killer like Gary Sonogy or Mr. Smith. But he's clever enough not to be caught. He's organized, reasonably careful. I don't think we'll find he has any prior record. He probably has a decent job, maybe even a family. My FBI friends at Quantico agree with that. He's almost definitely caught up in an escalating fantasy cycle. I think he's into his fantasies big time. Maybe he's in the process of becoming someone or something new. He might be forming a new personality for himself. He isn't finished with the killing. Not by any means. I'll make some educated guesses. He hates his old self, though the people closest to him probably don't realize it. He might be ready to abandon his family, job, any friends he has. At one time, he probably had very strong feelings and beliefs about something. Law and order, religion, the government. But not anymore. He kills in different ways. There's no set formula. He knows a lot about killing people. He's used different kinds of weapons. He may have traveled overseas. Or maybe he's spent time in Asia. I think it's very possible he's a black man. He's killed several times in Southeast. No one's noticed him.
Fuck me, Jerome Thurman said to that. Any good news, Alex?
One thing, and this is a long shot, but it feels right to me. I think he might be suicidal. It fits the profile I'm working on. He's living dangerously, taking a lot of chances. He might just blow himself up.
Pop goes the weasel, Sampson said.
That was how he came to name the killer. The Weasel. Chapter 13. Jeffrey Schaefer looked forward to playing the Four Horsemen every Thursday night from 9 until about 1 in the morning. The fantasy game was everything to him. There were 3 other master players around the world. The players were the rider on the white horse, Conqueror, the rider on the red horse, War, the rider on the black horse, Famine, and himself, the rider on the pale horse, Death. Lucy and the children knew they were forbidden to disturb him for any reason once he locked himself into the library on the second floor. On one wall was his collection of ceremonial daggers, nearly all of them purchased in Hong Kong and Bangkok. Also on the wall was the rowing oar from the year his college team had won the Bumps. Schaefer nearly always won the games he played. He had been using the internet to communicate with the other players for years, long before the rest of the world caught on. Conqueror played from the town of Dorking in Surrey, outside London. Famine traveled back and forth between Bangkok, Sydney, Melbourne, and Manila. And War usually played out of Jamaica, where he had a large estate on the sea. They had been playing horsemen for 7 years. Rather than becoming repetitive, the fantasy game had expanded itself. It had grown every year, becoming something new and even more challenging. The object was to create the most delicious and unusual fantasy or adventure. Violence was always part of the game, but not necessarily murder. Schaefer had been the first to claim that his stories weren't fantasies at all, that he lived them in the real world. Now the others would do so as well from time to time. Whether they really lived their fantasies, Schaefer couldn't tell. The object was to create the evening's most startling fantasy, to get a rise out of the other players. At 9 o'clock his time, Schaefer was on his laptop. So were the others. It was rare for one of them to miss a session, but if he did, he left lengthy messages and sometimes drawings or even photographs of supposed lovers or victims. Films were occasionally used, and the other players then had to decide whether the scenes were stage-acted or cinema verite. Schaefer couldn't imagine missing a chapter of the game himself. Death was by far the most interesting character, the most powerful and original. He had missed important social and embassy affairs just to be available for Thursday nights. He had played when he had pneumonia, and once he'd had a painful double hernia operation the day before. The Four Horsemen was unique in so many ways, but most important was the fact that there was no single game master to outline and control the action of the game. Each of the players had complete autonomy to write and visualize his own story, as long as he played by the roll of the dice and remained inside the parameters of the character. In effect, in Horsemen, there were four game masters. There was no other fantasy game like it. It was as gruesome and shocking as the participants' imaginations and their skills at presentation brought them. Conqueror, Famine, and War had all signed on. Schaefer began to type. Death has triumphed again in Washington. Let me tell you the details, then I'll listen to the glorious stories, the imaginative power of Conqueror, Famine, and War. I live for this, as I know all of you do as well. This weekend I drove my fantastic taxi, the Nightmare Machine, once again. Listen to this. I came upon several choice and delectable victims, but I rejected them as unworthy. Then I found my queen, and she reminded me of our days in Bangkok and Manila. Who could ever forget the bloodlust of the boxing arena? I held a mock kickboxing match. Gentlemen, I beat her with my hands and feet. I am sending pictures. Chapter 14.
Something was up, and I didn't think I'd like it very much. I arrived at the 7th District Police Station just before 7:30 the following morning. I'd been summoned by the powers that be to the station, and it was a tough deal. I'd worked until 2 in the morning trying to get a lead on Nina Child's murder. I had a feeling that the day was starting out wrong. I was tense and more uptight than I usually let myself become. I didn't like this early morning command appearance one bit. I shook my head, frowned, tried to roll the kinks out of my neck. Finally, I gritted my teeth tightly before opening the mahogany door. Chief of Detectives George Pittman was lying in wait in his office, which in fact consists of 3 connecting offices, including a conference room. The jefe, as he's called by his many admirers, had on a boxy gray business suit, an overstarched white shirt, and a silver necktie. His gray and white streaked hair was slicked back. He looked like a banker. And in some ways he is one. As he never tires of saying, he is working with a fixed budget and is always mindful of manpower costs, overtime costs, caseload costs.
Apparently, he is an efficient manager, which is why the police commissioner overlooks the fact that he's a bully, bigot, racist, and careerist. Up on his wall were three large, important-looking pushpin maps. The first showed two consecutive months of rapes, homicides, and assaults in Washington. The second map did the same for residential and commercial burglaries. The third map showed auto thefts. The maps and the Post said that crime was down in D.C., but not where I live.
"Do you know why you're here? Why I wanted to see you?" Pittman asked point blank.
No socializing or small talk from the jefe. No niceties.
"Of course you do, Dr. Cross. You're a psychologist. You're supposed to know how the human mind works. I keep forgetting that."
"Be cool. Be careful," I told myself. I did the thing Chief Pittman least expected. I smiled, then said softly, "No, I really don't know. I got a call from your assistant, so I'm here." Pittman smiled back, as if I'd made a pretty good joke. Then he suddenly raised his voice, and his face and neck turned bright red. His nostrils flared, exposing the bristly hairs in his nose. One of his hands was clenched into a tight fist, while the other was stretched open. His fingers were as rigid as the pencils sticking up from the leather cup on his desk.
"You're not fooling anybody, Cross, least of all me. I'm fully fucking aware that you're investigating homicides in Southeast that you aren't assigned to, the so-called Jane Doe's. You're doing this against my explicit orders. Some of those cases have been closed for over a year. I won't have it. I won't tolerate your insubordination, your condescending attitude. I know what you're trying to pull. Embarrass the department, specifically embarrass me. Curry fucking favor with the mayor, making yourself some kind of folk hero in Southeast in the process."
I hated Pittman's tone and what he was saying, but I learned one trick a long time ago, and it was probably the most important thing to know about politics inside any organization. It's so simple, but it's the key to every petty kingdom, every fiefdom. Knowledge truly is power. It's everything. And if you don't have any, pretend you do. So I told Chief Pittman nothing. I didn't contradict him. I didn't admit to a thing. I did nothing. Me and Mahatma Gandhi. I let him think that maybe I was investigating old cases in Southeast, but I didn't admit to it. I also let him think that maybe I had some powerful connections with Mayor Monroe, and God only knows who else in the city on the hill. I let him think that maybe I was after his job, or that I might have, God forbid, even loftier aspirations. I'm working the homicides assigned to me. Check with the captain. I'm doing my best to close as many cases as I can. Pittman nodded curtly. One nod. His face was still heart attack red.
"All right. I want you to close this case, and I want you to close it fast. A tourist was robbed and gunned down on M Street last night," he said. "A well-respected German doctor from Munich. It's front fucking page in today's Post. Not to mention the International Herald Tribune and every newspaper in Germany, of course. I want you on that murder case, and I want it solved pronto."
"This doctor, he's a white man?" I asked, keeping my expression neutral.
"I told you he's German."
"I already have a number of open cases in Southeast," I said to Pittman. "A nurse was murdered over the weekend." He didn't want to hear it. He shook his head, one shake.
"And now you have an important case in Georgetown. Solve it, Cross. You're to work on nothing else. That's a direct order. From the jefe."
Chapter 15. As soon as Cross walked out of Chief Pittman's inner office, a senior homicide detective named Patsy Hampton slipped in through a side door that led to the attached conference room. Detective Hampton had been instructed by Pittman to listen in on everything, to evaluate the situation from a street cop's perspective, to advise and to counsel. Hampton didn't like the job, but those were her orders from Pittman. She didn't like Pittman either. He was wound so tight that if you stuck coal up his ass, in a couple of weeks you'd have a diamond. He was mean and petty and vengeful.
"You see what I'm dealing with here? Cross knows how to push all my buttons. In the beginning he would lose his temper. Now he just ignores what I say."
"I heard everything,"
Hampton said. He's slick, all right. She was going to agree with Chief Pittman, no matter what he said. Patsy Hampton was an attractive woman, with sandy blonde hair cut short and the most piercing blue eyes this side of Stockholm. She was 31 years old, and on a very fast track in the department. At 26, she'd been the youngest homicide detective in Washington. Now she had much loftier goals in mind.
You're selling yourself short, though. You got to him. I know you did.
She told Pittman what he wanted to hear. He just internalizes it pretty well.
You're sure he's meeting with those other detectives? Pittman asked her.
They've met three times that I know of, always at Cross's house on Fifth Street. I suspect there have been other times. I heard about it through a friend of Detective Thurman.
But they don't meet while any of them is on duty?
No, not to my knowledge. They're careful. They meet on their own time. Pittman scowled and shook his head.
That's too goddamn bad. It makes it harder to prove anything really damaging.
From what I've heard, they believe the department is holding back resources that could clear a number of unsolved homicides in Southeast and parts of Northeast. Most of the murders involve black and Hispanic women. Pittman tensed his jaw and looked away from Hampton.
The numbers that Cross uses are complete bullshit, he said angrily. They're dog shit. It's all political with him. How much financial resource can we put against the murders of drug addicts and prostitutes in Southeast? It's criminals murdering other criminals. You know how it goes in those black neighborhoods?
Hampton nodded again, still agreeing when she saw the chance. She was afraid she'd lost him, said the wrong thing by speaking the truth. They think that at least some of the victims were innocent women from their neighborhoods. That ER nurse who was killed over the weekend? She was a friend of Cross and Detective John Sampson. Cross thinks a killer could be loose in Southeast, preying on women.
A serial killer in the ghetto? Give me a break. We've never had one there. They're rare in any inner city. Why now? Why here? Because Cross wants to find one, that's why.
Cross and the others would counter that by saying we've never seriously tried to catch this squirrel. Pittman's small eyes suddenly burned into her skull.
Do you agree with that horseshit, detective?
No, sir. I don't necessarily agree or disagree. I know for a fact that the department doesn't have enough resources anywhere in the city, with the possible exception of Capitol Hill. Now that's political, and it's an outrage.
Pittman smiled at her answer. The chief knew she was playing him a little, but he liked her anyway. He liked just being in a room with Patsy Hampton. She was such a doll, such a cutie.
What do you know about Cross, Patsy?
She sensed that the chief had vented enough. Now he wanted their talk to be more informal. She was certain that he liked her, had a crush on her, but he was too uptight to ever act on his desires, thank God.
I know Cross has been on the force for just over 8 years. He's currently the liaison between the department and the FBI, works with the Violent Criminal Apprehension Program. He's a profiler with a good reputation, from what I hear. Has a PhD in psych from Johns Hopkins. Private practice for 3 years before he came to us. Widower, 2 kids, plays the blues and the piano at his house.
That enough background? What more do you want to know? I've done my homework.
You know me,
Hampton said, and finally smiled. Pittman was smiling now, too. He had small teeth with spaces between them, and always made her think of Eastern European refugees or maybe Russian gangsters. Detective Hampton smiled, though. She knew he liked it when she played along with him, as long as he thought she respected him.
Any other worthwhile observations at this point? He asked.
You're such a softy, flabby dick, Patsy Hampton wanted to say, but she just shook her head.
He has some charm. He's well-connected in political circles. I can see why you're concerned about him.
You think Cross is charming?
I told you he's slick. He is. People say he looks like young Muhammad Ali. I think he likes to play the part sometimes. Dance like a butterfly, sting like a bee.
She laughed again, and so did he.
We're going to nail Cross, Pittman said.
We'll send him flying back to private practice. Wait and see. You're going to help get it done. You get things done. Right, Detective Hampton? You see the bigger picture. That's what I like about you.
She smiled again. That's what I like about me, too. Chapter 16. The British Embassy is a plain, federal-style building located at 3100 Massachusetts Avenue. Its immediate neighbors are the Vice President's House and the Observatory. The Ambassador's residence is a stately Georgian building with tall, flowing white columns. The Chancery is the actual office building. Geoffrey Schaefer sat behind his small mahogany desk at the Embassy and stared out onto Massachusetts Avenue. The Embassy staff currently counted 415 people, soon to be cut to 414, he was thinking to himself. The staff included defense experts, foreign policy specialists, trade, public affairs, clerks, and secretaries. Although the United States and Britain have an agreement not to spy on each other, Geoffrey Schaefer was nonetheless a spy. He was one of 11 men and women from the Security Service, formerly known as MI6, who worked at the embassy in Washington. These 11, in turn, ran agents attached to the consulates general in Atlanta, Boston, Chicago, Houston, Los Angeles, New York, and San Francisco. He was feeling restless as hell today, getting up from his desk frequently, pacing back and forth across the carpet that covered the creaking parquet floors. He made phone calls he didn't need to make, tried to get some work done, thought about how much he despised his job and the everyday details of life. He was supposed to be working on a truly silly communique about the government's absurd ongoing commitment to human rights. The foreign secretary had rather bombastically proclaimed that Britain would support the international condemnation of regimes that violate human rights, support international bodies involved in the cause, and denounce human rights abuses, blah, 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 ad nauseam. He glanced through a few of the computer games he enjoyed when he was uptight like this. Riven, Mech Commander, Unreal, Toka, Ultimate Soccer Manager. None of them appealed to him right now. Nothing did. He was starting to crash, and he knew the feeling. I'm going down, and there is only one certain way to stop it. Play the Four Horsemen. To make matters worse, it was raining and woefully gray-skied outside. The city of Washington, and also the surrounding countryside, looked forlorn and depressing. It sucked. Christ, he was in a bad mood, even for him. He continued to stare east across Massachusetts Avenue, looking into the trees bordering a park dedicated to the pacifist bullshit artist Khalil Gibran. He tried to daydream, mostly about fucking various attractive women currently working at the embassy. He had called his psychiatrist, Boo Cassidy, at her home office, but she was about to start a session and couldn't talk for long. They agreed to meet after work. A nasty quickie at her place before he went home to face Lucy and the sniveling brood. He didn't dare play horseman again tonight. It was too soon after the nurse. But God Almighty, he wanted to play. He wished he could take somebody out in some very imaginative way, right there inside the embassy. He did have one excellent thing to do today, saving it until now, 3 p.m. He had used the dice already. Played a bit of horseman, just to help him make a personnel decision. He had called Sarah Middleton just before lunch and told her they needed to have a chat, and could she stop by his office, say, at 3? Sarah was obviously tense on the phone and told him she could do it earlier, any time, at his convenience.
"Not busy, then? Nothing much to do today?"
Schaefer asked. 3 o'clock would be fine, she answered hastily. His secretary, the bestial Betty, formerly from Belgravia, buzzed him promptly at 3. At least he'd finally gotten through to her about punctuality. Schaefer let her buzz him several times, then picked up the phone abruptly as if she'd interrupted him at something vital to security.
"What is it, Ms. Thomas? I'm extremely busy with this communique for the secretary." "I'm sorry to disturb you, Mr. Schaefer, but Ms. Middleton is here. You have a 3 o'clock appointment with her, I understand."
Do I? Yes, you're right. Can you ask Sarah to wait? I'll need a few more minutes. I'll buzz when I'm ready to see her."
Schaefer smiled contentedly and picked up a copy of The Red Coat, the embassy's employee newsletter. He knew Betty hated it when he used Miss Middleton's Christian name, Sarah. He fantasized about Sarah for the next few moments. He'd wanted to have a go at Miss Middleton from their first interview, but he was too careful for that. God, he hated the bitch. This was going to be such fun. Schaefer watched the rain hammer down on the traffic crossing Massachusetts Avenue for another 10 minutes. Finally, he snatched up the phone. He couldn't wait a minute longer.
I'll see her now. Send Sarah in.
He fingered his 20-sided dice. This could be fun, actually. Terror at the office. Chapter 17. The lovely Sarah Middleton entered his office and managed a cordial look, almost a smile. He felt like a boa constrictor eyeing a mouse. She had naturally curly red hair, a moderately pretty face, a superior figure. Today she wore a very short suit, a red V-necked silk blouse, black stockings. It was obvious to Schaefer that she was out to catch a husband in Washington. Schaefer's pulse was beating hard. He was aroused by her, always had been. He thought about taking her, and very much liked that phrase. She didn't look as nervous and unsure of herself as she had recently, so that probably meant she was really scared and trying not to show it. He tried his best to think like Sarah. That made it more fun, though he found it a real challenge to be as squirrely and insecure as she would surely be.
"We certainly needed the rain," Sarah said,
and then cringed before the sentence was even finished.
"Sarah, please sit down," he said.
He was trying to keep a straight business face.
"Personally, I loathe the rain. It's one of the many reasons I've never been stationed in London."
He sighed theatrically behind the rigid tent he'd made with his fingers. He wondered if Sarah noticed the length of his fingers, and if she ever thought about how large he was elsewhere. He would bet anything that she did. It was how people's minds worked, though women like Sarah would never admit to it. She cleared her throat, then put her hands on her knees. The knuckles of her fingers were white. Christ, he was enjoying her obvious discomfort. She looked ready to jump out of her skin. How about out of her tight little skirt and blouse? He began to stretch the fingers on his right hand, playing his part as dominator to the hilt.
"Sarah, I think I have some bad news. Quite unfortunate, really, but can't be avoided."
She sat nervously forward in her chair. She really was nicely built up top. He was getting hard now.
"What is it, Mr. Schaefer? What do you mean? You think you have bad news? You do or you don't?" "We have to let you go. I have to let you go. Budget cuts, I'm afraid," he said. "I know you must find this immensely unfair and unexpected as well. Particularly when you moved halfway across the world from Australia to take this job, and you've been living in Washington for less than 6 months. Suddenly, the axe falls."
He could tell she was actually fighting back tears. Her lips were trembling. Obviously, she never expected this. She had no idea. She was a reasonably smart and controlled woman, but she couldn't help herself now. Excellent. He had succeeded in breaking her down. He wished he had a movie camera this minute to record the look on her face and play it back countless times in private. He saw the very instant that she lost it and treasured it. He watched her eyes moisten, saw the large tears roll over her cheeks, streaking her working girl makeup. He felt the power, and it was as good as he'd hoped it would be. A small, insignificant game, certainly, but a delicious one. He loved being able to instill such shock and pain.
"Poor Sarah, poor, poor dear," he murmured.
Then Schaefer did the cruelest, most unforgivable thing, also the most outrageous and dangerous. He got up from his desk and came around to comfort her. He stood behind her, pressing himself against her shoulders. He knew it was the last thing she wanted, to be touched by him, to feel that he was aroused. She stiffened and pulled away from him as if he were on fire.
"Bastard!"
she said, between clenched teeth.
"You are a consummate prick."
Sarah left his office, shaking and in tears, running in that stumbling way women often do in heels. Schaefer loved it. The sadistic pleasure, not only of hurting someone, but of destroying this innocent woman. He memorized the stunning image for all time. He would play it back over and over. Yes, he was a prick. Consummate indeed. Chapter 18. Rosie the cat was perched on the windowsill watching me dress for my date with Christine. I envied the simplicity of her life. Loved to eat those mousies. Mousies what I love to eat. I finally headed downstairs. I was taking the night off from work, and I was more nervous, distracted, and fidgety than I had been in a long time. Nana and the kids knew something was up, but they didn't know what, and it was driving my three favorite busybodies crazy.
"Daddy, tell me what's going on. Please."
Johnny clasped her hands in prayer and begged. "I told you no, and no is no, not even if you get down on your bony little knees," I said and smiled. "I have a date tonight. It's just a date. That's all you need to know, young lady."
"Is it with Christine?" Johnny asked. "At least you can tell me that much."
"That's for me to know," I said as I knotted my tie in the mirror beside the stairs. "And you not to find out, my over-inquisitive girlfriend."
"You're wearing your fancy blue-striped suit, your fancy dancing shoes, that fancy tie you like. You're so fancy."
"Do I look good?" I turned and asked my personal clothier. "For my date?"
"You look beautiful, Daddy."
My girl beamed, and I knew I could believe her. Her eyes were shiny little mirrors that always told the truth.
"You know you do. You know you're handsome as sin."
"That's my girl," I said, and laughed again. Handsome as sin. She got that one from Nana, no doubt. Damon mimicked his sister.
"You look beautiful, Daddy. What a little brown noser. What do you want from Daddy, Janny?"
"Do I look good?" I turned to Damon. He rolled his eyes.
"You look all right. How come you're all dooted up? You can tell me, man to man, what's the big deal?"
"Answer the poor children," Nana finally said.
I looked her way and offered up a wide grin. "Don't use the poor children to try to get your gossip quotient for the day." "Well, I'm off," I announced. "I'll be home before sunrise."
"Mwah!"
I did my favorite monster imitation, and all three of them rolled their eyes. It was a minute or so before 8, and as I stepped onto the porch, a black Lincoln Town Car pulled up in front of the house. It was right on time, and I didn't want to be late.
"A limousine?" Janny gasped and nearly swooned on the front porch. "You're going out in a limousine?"
"Alex Cross," Nana said, "what is going on?"
I practically danced down the steps. I got into the waiting car, shut the door, told the driver to go. I waved out the back window and stuck out my tongue as the car smoothly pulled away from our house. Chapter 19. My last image was of the three of them, Janny, Damon, and Nana, all mugging and sticking out their tongues at me. We do have some fabulously good times together, I was thinking as the car headed over to Prince George's County, where I had once confronted a homicidal 12-year-old during the halcyon days of the Jack and Jill killers, and where Christine Johnson lived. I had my mantra all set for tonight. Heart leads head. I needed to believe that was so.
"A private car? A limousine?" Christine exclaimed when I picked her up at her house in Mitchellville.
She looked as stunningly beautiful as I'd ever seen her, and that's saying a lot. She wore a long sleeveless black shift, black satin pumps with straps, and had a floral brocade jacket draped over her arm. The heels made her a little over 6 feet tall. God, how I love this woman. Everything about her. We walked to the car and got inside.
"You haven't told me where we're going tonight, Alex. Just that it was fancy, someplace special."
"Ah, but I've told our driver," I said. I tapped the partition window, and the town car moved off into the summer night. Alex the Mysterious. I held Christine's hands as we drove along on the John Hanson Highway back toward Washington. Her face tilted toward mine, and I kissed her in the cozy darkness. I loved the sweetness of her mouth, her lips, the softness and smoothness of her skin. She was wearing a new perfume that I didn't recognize, and I liked that, too. I kissed the hollow of her throat, then her cheeks, her eyes, her hair. I would have been happy to do just this for the rest of the night.
"It is unbelievably romantic," she finally said. "It is special. You are something else. Sugar."
We cuddled and hugged all the way into Washington. We talked, but I don't remember the subject. I could feel her breasts rising and falling against me. I was surprised when we arrived at the intersection of Massachusetts and Wisconsin Avenues. We were getting close to the surprise. True to her word, Christine hadn't asked any more questions. Not until the car eased up in front of Washington National Cathedral, and the driver got out and held the door open for us.
"The National Cathedral," she said. "We're going in here?"
I nodded and stared up at the stunning Gothic masterpiece that I'd admired since I was a boy. The cathedral crowns over 50 acres of lawns and woods and is Washington's highest point, even higher than the Washington Monument. If I remembered correctly, it was the second largest church in the United States, and possibly the prettiest. I led the way, and Christine followed me inside. She held my hand lightly. We entered the northwest corner of the nave, which extends nearly a tenth of a mile to the massive altar. Everything felt special and very beautiful, spiritual, just right. We walked up to a pew under the amazing space window at mid-nave. Everywhere I looked, there were priceless stained glass windows, over 200 in all. The light inside was exquisite. I felt blessed. There was a kaleidoscope of changing colors on the walls, reds, warm yellows, cool blues. "Beautiful, isn't it?" I whispered. "Timeless, sublime. All that good Gothic stuff Henry Adams used to write about."
"Oh, Alex, I think it's the prettiest spot in Washington. The space window, the children's chapel. I've always loved it here." "I told you that, didn't I?" she asked.
"You might have mentioned it once," I said. "Or maybe I just knew it." We continued walking until we entered the children's chapel. It is small, beautiful, and wonderfully intimate. We stood under a stained glass window that depicts the story of Samuel and David as children. I turned and looked at Christine, and my heart was beating so loud I was sure she could hear it. Her eyes were sparkling like jewels in the flickering candlelight. The black dress shimmered and seemed to flow over her body. I knelt on one knee and looked up at her. "I've loved you since the first time I saw you at the Sojourner Truth School," I whispered, so that only she could hear me. "Except that when I saw you the first time, I had no way of knowing how incredibly special you are on the inside. How wise, how good. I didn't know that I could feel the way I do, whole and complete, whenever I'm with you. I would do anything for you, or just to be with you for one more moment." I stopped for the briefest pause and took a deep breath. She held my eyes, didn't pull away. "I love you so much, and I always will. Will you marry me, Christine?" She continued to look into my eyes, and I saw such warmth and love, but also humility, which is always a part of who Christine is. It was almost as if she couldn't imagine my loving her.
"Yes, I will. Oh, Alex, I shouldn't have waited until tonight. But this is so perfect, so special. I'm almost glad I did. Yes, I will be your wife."
I took out an antique engagement ring and gently slid it onto Christine's finger. The ring had been my mother's, and I'd kept it since she died, when I was 9. The exact history of the ring was unclear, except that it went back at least 4 generations in the Cross family, and was my one and only heirloom. We kissed in the glorious children's chapel of the National Cathedral, and it was the best moment of my life, never to be forgotten, never to be diminished in any way. Yes, I will be your wife. Chapter 20. 10 days had passed without another fantasy murder, but now a powerful mood swing had taken hold of Jeffrey Schaefer, and he let himself go with the flow. He was flying high as a kite, hyper, manic, bipolar, whatever the doctors wanted to call his condition. He'd already taken Ativan, Librium, Valium, and Depakote, but the drugs seemed only to fuel his jets. That night, at around 6, he pulled the black Jaguar out of the lot on the north side of the embassy, passing by the larger-than-life Winston Churchill statue with its stubby right hand raised in V for victory, its left hand holding his trademark cigar. Eric Clapton played guitar loudly on the car's CD. He turned up the volume higher, slapping his hands hard on the steering wheel, feeling the rhythm, the beat, the primal urge. Schaefer turned onto Massachusetts Avenue and then stopped at a Starbucks. He hurried in and fixed up 3 coffees his way, black as his heart, with 6 sugars. Mm-hmm. As usual, he had nearly finished the first before he got to the cash register. Once he was inside the cockpit of his Jag again, he sipped a second cup at a more leisurely pace. He downed some Benadryl and Nascan. Couldn't hurt, might help. He took out the 20-sided game dice. He had to play tonight. Anything 12 or higher would dispatch him directly to Boo Cassidy's place for a kinky quickie before he went home to the dreaded family. A 7 to 11 was total disaster, straight home to Lucy and the kids. 3, 4, 5, or 6 meant he could go to the hideaway for an unscheduled night of high adventure.
Come, 3, 4, 5. Come, baby, come. I need this tonight. I need a fix. I need it.
He shook the dice for what must have been 30 seconds. He made the suspense last, drew it out. Finally, he released the dice onto the gray leather car seat. He watched the roll closely.
Jesus, he'd thrown a 4. Defied the odds. His brain was on fire. He could play tonight. The dice had spoken. Fate had spoken.
He excitedly punched a number on his cell phone.
Lucy,
he said, and he was smiling already.
Glad I caught you at home, darling. Yes, you guessed it first try. We are completely swamped here again. Can you believe it? I certainly can't. They think they own me, and I suppose they're half right. It's the drug trafficking rubbish again. I'll be home when I can. Don't wait up, though. Love to the kids. Kisses to everybody. Me too, darling. I love you too. You're the best, the most understanding wife alive.
Very well played, Schaefer thought, as he breathed a sigh of relief. Excellent performance, considering the drugs he'd taken. Schaefer disconnected from his wife, whose family money, unfortunately, paid for the townhouse, the holidays away, even the Jag, and her fashionable Range Rover, of course. He punched another number on the cell phone.
Dr. Cassidy.
He heard her voice almost immediately. She knew it was him. He usually called her from the car on his way over to see her. They'd like to get each other hot and bothered on the phone. Telephone sex as foreplay.
They've done it to me again,
Schaefer whined miserably into the phone. But he was smiling again, loving his flair for the overdramatic. A short silence, then...
You mean they did it to us, don't you? There's no way you can get away. It's only a bloody job, and one you detest, Jeff.
You know I would if I possibly could. I do hate it here. Loathe every moment. And it's even worse at home, Boo. Jesus, you of all people know that.
He imagined the tight little frown and Boo's pursing her lips.
You sound high, Jeffrey. Are you, dear? Take your pills today?
Don't be horrible. Of course I've taken my medications. I am rushed. I am high. On the ceiling, as a matter of fact. I'm calling between blasted staff meetings. Oh, hell, I miss you, Boo. I want to be inside you. Deep inside you. I want to do your pussy, your ass, your throat. I'm thinking about it right now. Christ, I'm as hard as a rock here in my government issue office. Have to beat it down with a stick. Cane it. That's how we British handle such things.
She laughed, and he almost changed his mind about standing her up.
Go back to work. I'll be at home if you finish early, she said. I could use a little finishing myself.
I love you, Boo. You're so kind to me.
I am. And I could probably get into a little caning, too.
He hung up and drove to the hideaway in Eckington. He parked the Jag next to the purple and blue taxi in the garage. He bounded upstairs to change for the game.
God, he loved this. His secret life, his nights away from everything and everyone he loathed.
He was taking too many chances now, but he didn't care. Chapter 21. Schaefer was totally pumped up for a night on the town. The Four Horsemen was on. Anything could happen tonight. Yet he found that he was introspective and pensive. He could flip from manic to depressive in the blink of an eye. He watched himself as if he were an observer in a dream. He had been an English intelligence officer, but now that the Cold War had ended, there was little use for his talents. It was only the influence of Lucy's father that had kept him in his job. Duncan Cousins had been a general in the army, and now was chairman of a packaged goods conglomerate specializing in the sale of detergents, soaps, and drugstore perfumes. He'd like to call Schaefer the Colonel, rubbing in his rise to mediocrity. The general also loved to talk about the glowing successes of Schaefer's two brothers, both of whom had made millions in business. Schaefer shifted his thoughts back to the present. He was doing that a lot lately, fading in and out like a radio with a bad connection. He took a settling breath, then pulled the taxi out of the garage. Moments later, he turned onto Rhode Island Avenue. It was beginning to rain again, a light mist that made the passing traffic lights blurry and impressionistic. Schaefer drifted over to the curb and stopped for a tall, slender black man. He looked like a drug dealer, something Schaefer had no use for. Maybe he would just shoot the bastard, then dump the body. That felt good enough for tonight's action, a sleazebag dope dealer whom nobody would miss. Airport, the man announced haughtily as he climbed inside the taxi. The inconsiderate bastard shook off rainwater onto the seat. Then he shut the creaking car door behind him and was on his cell phone immediately. Schaefer wasn't going to the airport, and neither was his first passenger of the night. He listened in on the phone call. The man's voice was affected, surprisingly cultured.
I think I'll just make the 9 o'clock, Leonard. It's Delta on the hour, right? I picked up a cab, thank the Lord Jesus. Most of them won't stop anywhere near where my poor mom lives in Northeast. Then along comes this purple and blue absolute wreck of a gypsy cab, and merciful God, it stops for me. Christ, he'd been identified.
Schaefer silently cursed his bad luck. That was the way of the game, though. Incredible highs and vicious lows. He would have to take this asshole all the way out to National Airport. If he disappeared, it would be connected to a purple and blue cab, an absolute wreck of a gypsy cab. Schaefer stepped on the accelerator and sped out toward National. The airport was backed up, even at 9 in the evening. He cursed under his breath. The rain was heavy and punctuated by rolling thunder and spits of lightning. He tried to control his building anger, his darkening mood. It took nearly 40 minutes to get to the bloody terminal and drop off the passenger. By that time, he'd settled back into another fantasy, had another huge mood swing. He was cycling up again. Maybe he should have gone to see Dr. Cassidy after all. He needed more pills, especially lithium. This was like a carnival ride tonight. Up and down, up and down. He wanted to push things as far as he could. He also felt crazed. He was definitely losing control. Anything could happen when he got like this. That was the thing. he pulled into the queue of taxis, waiting to get a fare back to D.C. As he got closer to the front of the line, there was more thunder. Lightning crackled high above the airport. He could see the prospective victims huddled under a dripping canopy. Flights were undoubtedly being postponed and canceled. He savored the cheap seat melodrama, the suspense. The victim du jour could be anyone, from a corporate executive to a harried secretary, or maybe even a whole family back from a vacation to Disney World. But not once did he look directly at the queue of potential victims as he inched closer and closer. He was almost there, just two more taxis in front of him. He could see the queue out of the corner of his eye. Finally, he had to snatch a quick peek. It was a tall male. He peeked again, couldn't help himself. A white male, a businessman, stepped off the curb and was climbing inside the taxi. He was cursing to himself, pissed off about the rain. Schaefer looked the man over. He was American, late 30s, full of himself. Investment analyst, maybe, or banker, something like that. "We can go whenever you're in the mood," the man snapped at him.
"Sorry, sir,"
Schaefer said, and smiled obsequiously into the rearview mirror. He dropped the dice on the front seat. Six! His heart began to hammer. Six meant immediate action. But he was still inside National Airport. There was a heavy lineup of traffic and cops, bright lights glittering everywhere. It was too dangerous, even for him. The dice had spoken. He had no choice. The game was on right now. A sea of red rear lights glowed at him. Cars were everywhere. How could he do this here? Schaefer began to perspire heavily. But he had to do it. That was the point of the game. He had to do it now. Had to murder this asshole right here at the airport. He swerved into the nearest parking area. This was not good. He sped down a narrow lane. Another bolt of lightning flashed overhead. It seemed to underscore the madness and chaos of the moment. "Where the hell are you going?" the businessman shouted at him. He slammed his palm into the back of the seat. "This isn't the way out, you ass!" Schaefer glared at the business creep in his rearview mirror. He hated him for calling him an ass. The bastard also reminded him of his brothers. "I'm not going anywhere," he yelled back. "But you're going straight to hell!" The businessman blubbered. "What did you say to me? What did you just say?" Schaefer fired his Smith & Wesson 9mm and hoped no one would hear it above the thunder and honking horns. He was soaking wet with perspiration, and he was afraid his black face would run and smear. He was expecting to be stopped at any moment, waiting for policemen to surround the taxi. Bright red blood was splattered all over the back seat and window. The businessman was slumped in the corner as if he were asleep. Schaefer couldn't see where the bloody bullet had exited the taxi. He made it out of National before he went completely mad. He drove carefully to Benning Heights and Southeast. He couldn't risk being stopped for speeding. But he was out of his head, not sure he was doing the right thing. He stopped on a side street, checked out the body, stripped it. He decided to dump the corpse out in the open. He was trying his best not to be predictable. Then he sped away from the crime scene and headed home. He'd left no identification on the victim, nothing but the body. Just a little surprise. A John Doe. Chapter 22. I got home from Christine's house at 2:30 in the morning, feeling exhilarated, the happiest I'd been in years. I thought about waking Nana and the kids to tell them the news. I wanted to see the surprised looks on their faces. I wished that I had brought Christine home with me, so we could celebrate together. The phone rang moments after I stepped inside the house. Oh, no, I thought. Not tonight. Nothing good comes from phone calls at 2:30 a.m. I picked up in the living room and heard Samson's voice on the line. "Sugar," he whispered. "Leave me alone," I said. "Try again in the morning. I'm closed for the night." "No, you're not, Alex. Not tonight. Get over to Alabama Avenue, about 3 blocks east of DuPont Park. A man was found there, naked and dead in the gutter. The guy is white, and there's no ID on him."
First thing in the morning, I would tell Nana and the kids about Christine and me. I had to go. The murder scene was a 10-minute ride across the Anacostia River. Samson was waiting for me on a street corner. So was the John Doe. And a lively, mean-spirited crowd. A naked, white body dumped in this neighborhood had prompted lots of curiosity, almost like seeing a deer walking down Alabama Avenue.
"Casper the Friendly Ghost been offed,"
a heckler contributed his 25 cents as Samson and I stooped down under the yellow plastic crime scene tape. In the background were rows of dilapidated brick buildings that almost seemed to scream out the names of the lost, the forgotten, the never had a chance. Stagnant water often pools on the street corners here since the storm drains are hardly ever inspected. I knelt over the twisted, naked body that was partly immersed in the cesspool. There would be no tire marks left at the watery scene. I wondered if the killer had thought of that. I was making mental notes. No need to write them down. I'd remember everything. The man had manicured fingernails and toenails. No calluses showed in either his hands or his feet. He had no bruises or distinct disfiguring marks, other than the cruel gunshot wound that had blown away the left side of his face. The body was deeply suntanned, except where he'd worn swim trunks. A thin, pale ring ran around his left index finger, where he'd probably worn a wedding band, which was missing. And there was no ID, just like the Jane Doe's. Death was clearly the result of the single devastating gunshot to the head. Alabama Avenue was the primary scene, where the body was found, but I suspected a secondary homicide scene, where the victim was actually murdered.
"What do you think?" Samson crouched down close beside me. His knees crackled loudly. "Son of a bitch killer is pissed off about something.
Really bizarre that he wound up here in Benning Heights. I don't know if he's connected to the Jane Does, but if he is, the killer wanted us to find this one in a hurry. Bodies around here usually get dumped in Fort DuPont Park. He's getting stranger and stranger. And you're right. He's very angry with the world." My mind was rapidly filling with crime scene notes, plus the usual stream of homicide detective questions. Why leave the body in a street gutter? Why not in an abandoned building? Why in Benning Heights? Was the killer black? That still made the most sense to me, but a very low percentage of pattern killers are black. The sergeant from the crime scene unit came strolling up to Samson and me.
"What do you want from us, detective?"
I looked back at the naked white body. "Videotape it, photograph it, sketch it," I told him.
"And take some of the trash in the gutter and sidewalk?"
"Take everything, even if it's soaking wet." The sergeant frowned.
"Everything? All this wet trash? Why?"
Alabama Avenue is hilly, and I could see the Capitol building brightly illuminated in the distance. It looked like a faraway celestial body, maybe heaven. It got me thinking about the haves in Washington and the have-nots.
"Just take everything. It's how I work," I said.
Chapter 23 Detective Patsy Hampton arrived at the chilling homicide scene around 2:15. The jefe's assistant had called her apartment about an unusual murder in Benning Heights that might relate to the Jane Does. This one was different in some ways, but there were too many similarities for her to ignore. She watched Alex Cross work the crime scene. She was impressed that he'd come out at this early hour. She was curious about him, had been for a long time. Hampton knew Cross by reputation and had followed a couple of his cases. She had even worked a few weeks on the tragic kidnapping of Maggie Rose Dunn and Michael Goldberg. So far, she had mixed feelings about Cross. He was personable enough, and more than good-looking. Cross was a tall, strongly put-together man. She felt that he received undeserved special treatment because he was a forensic psychologist. She'd done her homework on Cross. Hampton understood that she had been assigned to show Cross up, to win, to knock him down a peg. She knew it would be a tough competition, but she also knew that she was the one to do it.
She never failed at anything.
She'd already done her own examination of the crime scene. She had stayed on at the scene only because Cross and Samson had unexpectedly shown up. She continued to study Cross, watched him walk the homicide scene several times. He was physically imposing, and so was his partner, who had to be at least 6'9". Cross was 6'3" and weighed maybe 200. He appeared younger than his age, which was 41. He seemed to be respected by the assisting patrolman, even by the EMS personnel. He shook a few hands, patted shoulders, occasionally shared a smile with someone working the crime scene. Hampton figured that was part of his act, though. Everybody had one these days, especially in Washington. Cross's was obviously his charisma and charm. Hell, she had an act herself. Hers was to appear non-threatening and feminine, then perform contrary to the expectations of the males on the force. She usually caught them off guard. As she'd risen in the department, the men had learned that she could be tough. Surprise, surprise. She worked longer hours than anyone else. She was a hell of a lot tougher than the men, and she never socialized with other cops. But she made one big mistake. She broke into a homicide suspect's car without a warrant and was caught by another detective, a jealous older male. That was how Pittman got his hooks into her, and now he wouldn't let go. At around 2:45, she walked to her forest green Explorer, noting that it needed a wash. She already had a few ideas about the dead man in the street. There was no doubt in her mind that she would beat Cross. Book 2. Death Rides a Pale Horse. Chapter 24. George Bayer was famine among the four horsemen. He'd been playing the fantasy game for 7 years, and he loved it. At least he had until recently, when Jeffrey Schaefer started to go out of control. Famine was physically unimpressive at around 5'8", 190 pounds. He was paunchy, balding, wore wire-rimmed glasses. But he also knew that his appearance was deceiving, and he'd made a living off those who underestimated him. People like Jeffrey Schaefer. He had reread a 40-page dossier on Schaefer during his long plane ride from Asia to Washington. The dossier told him everything about Schaefer, and also about the character he played, Death. At Dulles Airport, he rented a dark blue Ford sedan under a false name. He was still detached and introspective during his 30-minute drive into the city. But he was also anxious. He was nervous for all of the horsemen, but especially for himself. He was the one who would have to confront Schaefer, and he was worried that Schaefer might be going mad, that he might blow up in all their faces. George Bayer had been an M-man, MI6, and he'd known Schaefer in the service. He had come to Washington to check out Schaefer firsthand. It was suspected by the other players that Jeffrey might have gone over the edge, that he was no longer playing by the rules and was a grave danger to them all. Since Bayer had once been stationed in Washington and knew the town, he was the one to go there. Bayer didn't want to be seen at the British Embassy on Massachusetts Avenue, but he had spoken to a few friends who he knew would keep silent about having been contacted. The news about Schaefer was as bad as he'd suspected. He was seeing women outside his marriage, and he wasn't being discreet. There was a psychologist who was also a sex therapist, and he had been observed going over to her place several times a week, often during working hours. It was rumored that he was drinking heavily and possibly taking drugs. Bayer suspected the latter. He and Schaefer had been friends, and they had done their share of drugs while posted in the Philippines and Thailand. Of course, they were younger and more foolish then. Or at least that was true of Bayer. The D.C. police had recently put in a complaint to the embassy about a reckless driving incident. Schaefer might have been high at the time. His current assignments at the embassy were minimal, and he would have been dismissed or sent back to England if it weren't for his wife's father, General Duncan Cousins. What a terrible mess Schaefer had made of his life. "But that's not the worst of it, is it, Jeffrey?" George Bayer was thinking as he drove into the section of northeast Washington known as Eckington Place. "There's more, isn't there, dear boy? It's much worse than the embassy thinks."
It's probably the biggest scandal in the long history of the Security Service, and you're right at the heart of it. But of course, so am I.
Bayer locked the doors of his car as he pulled up to a traffic light. The area looked highly suspicious to him, like so much of Washington these days. What a sad, totally insane country America had become. What a perfect refuge for Schaefer. Famine took in the sights on the mean streets as he continued through the decidedly lower-class neighborhood. There was nothing to compare with this in London. Row upon row of two-storied red-brick garden apartments, many of them in dreadful disrepair. Not so much urban decay as urban apathy. He saw Schaefer's lair up ahead and pulled over to the curb. He knew the exact location of the hideaway from the elaborate fantasy tales Schaefer had spun for his fellow players. He knew the address. Now he needed to know one more thing. Were the murders that Jeffrey claimed he'd committed fantasies, or were they real? Was he actually a cold-blooded killer, operating here in Washington? Bayer walked to the garage door. It took him only a moment to pick the lock and let himself in. He had heard so much about the nightmare machine, the purple and blue taxi that Schaefer used for the murders. He was looking at it. The taxi was as real as he was. Now he knew the truth. George Bayer shook his head. Schaefer had killed all of those people. This was no longer a game. Chapter 25. Bayer trudged upstairs to the hideaway apartment. His arms and legs felt heavy, and he had a slight pain in his chest. His vision was tunneled. He pulled down the dusty blinds and began to look around. Schaefer had boastfully described the garage and taxi several times during the game. He had flaunted the existence of the hideaway and sworn to the other players that it was real and not just some fantasy in a role-playing game.
This book is continued on Disc 3.